Well, it's good to see you all today. My name is Jay. I'm one of the pastors here. Some of you, I think, have come during the time I was on vacation, so we need to do introductions again. You know, looking at this gospel just for a second, because we're moving into the Old Testament for our conversation today, but don't you wish Jesus would explain everything that clearly? Lord, give me an explanation, and then he lays it out. That would be great, wouldn't it? Do you remember what you dreamed last night? We all dream. We do, although we don't always remember what the dreams were about. Some are pleasant dreams. Some are frightening. Some we're really glad when we realize it's only a dream. Because you have those times, don't you, when you're like, oh, wow, what's going on here? And then you sort of realize, oh, it's a dream, okay. I think those who are in public positions where we do public performance or speaking and so on, we have a standard dream about either being unprepared or inappropriately attired or something like that. There's probably a dream for every profession that's a good dream and a frightening one. But you know, dreams have been of interest to seers, to philosophers, and even to scientists now for thousands of years. Each age seems to have its own way of relating to dreams. And the fact that we dream, what those dreams are about, is important. For some neuroscientists, it's just the way the brain fires signals. For others, dreams hold deeper and mysterious meanings. Now, I'm going to share a little something of myself, which I do from time to time, but you just need to know I have pretty amazing dreams. And when I share them with the people, they're like, really? You dream that? Doesn't everybody? And they're like short stories. They're like narratives. And they're usually very vivid. At least the ones that I remember are very vivid. And they're pretty easy to interpret, too. If something's going on in my life, then it doesn't, you know, it's not too hard to figure out what the dream's getting at. But not always. Sometimes they're just strange. It was not long ago I had a dream where I was in a plane that was flying at night. And the plane was flying all over the place, up and down. And it was like a cargo plane. There were no seats. And I was in the back of the plane. And when the plane would climb, then I would slide way to the back. And when it would dive, then I would slide way to the front of the plane. And I was afraid it would crash. And during one of the climbs, I clawed my way on the floor of the plane up to the cockpit because I wanted to see who is flying this plane and what is going on. And I opened the door to the cockpit, and you would think it would be Bob Decker flying the plane, but it wasn't. It was Margaret Thatcher. I'm not making this up. My dreams are like Stephen King meets Lewis Carroll. So dreams can be strange. But they are also, at times, I think, very important. Today we heard a story read for us that we know, most people know pretty well. In fact, it's the most famous dream in the Bible. You'll know that this dream has been written about in music, in literature. You have a panel on the front of your bulletin from Marc Chagall, who did a number of settings of this Jacob's ladder story in his art. In the reading, we have Jacob channeling a very early version of Stairway to Heaven. And that's really what it is. The word ladder is probably better given to us as stairway. Stairway. This dream is important, and it raises questions of when is a dream not a dream? When is a dream something more? Well, when you're Jacob on the run from your brother who wants to kill you, and you're having to face the music of your own actions, and you're caught in the desert by grace and a promise, then the dream is not just a dream. It's much more. I want to review a little bit where we are, how we got to this place in Genesis. We're in a series of semi-continuous readings. That's a way of saying that we're going through Genesis, but not everything in Genesis. It's sort of jumping to the high points and not all of the high points. It's the story of Abraham's family. It's the saga of a family. And last week we met Jacob, who is Abraham's grandson. He has a twin brother, Esau, and Jacob is the younger of the two. But from the very outset, he grasped to be first. He didn't like being number two, and his father, Isaac, didn't help matters much, since he favored number one, Esau. So Jacob's mother took his side, and it set up patterns for dysfunction, serious dysfunction, patterns that drew out deception and scheming and manipulation and lying on the part of this son who was already insecure and fearful. I mention that to see that there's a lot going on. We look at Jacob and his character, and that's important, but it's not the only thing. There were others that played into this drama of dysfunction. In fact, it was the whole family. So through trickery, his own trickery, through his mother's help, Esau's greed, and his father's distance, Jacob steals the birthright and the blessing. I know you covered this last week, and I was able to listen into Amanda's sermon. And she had mentioned, and I think it's an important point, that God had already decided to bless Jacob. He'd already decided that he would give Jacob the blessing, and that's for reasons known only to God. It wasn't because Jacob had such wonderful character we hadn't seen yet. But Jacob took what God had already intended to give him. Jacob took it by deception and subterfuge. It's a mess. The family is a mess. The relationship between the brothers has totally broken down. And in fact, Esau declares that he will kill Jacob if it's the last thing he does. So to save his skin, something he's good at, Jacob leaves. He sets out. The idea is that he'll go back to where the family came from, to among his mother's family, to take a wife. That's over 500 miles away, a journey on foot. But really, he's entered exile. That's what he's done. He's banished. He's cast out by his own self-will and his false heart. It's an exile of his own making. And that's where we find him today. So that's where the reading picks up. Banishment is, for some, worse punishment than death. To be banished from your community, to be sent out. You've lost your place, you've lost your people, you've lost your relationships, you've lost your past and your future. You may have heard it put like this. Ha, banishment. Be merciful, say death. For exile hath no more terror in his look, much more than death. Do not say banishment. There is no world without Verona walls but purgatory, torture, and hell itself. Hence, banished is banished from the world, and world's exile is death. Then banished is death misnamed. Calling death banishment, thou cutst my head off with a golden axe and smilest upon the stroke that murders me. That's Romeo from Shakespeare, who basically decides that banishment is worse than death, and that's the path that he takes. Jacob is banished. He's on the run. He's fleeing certain death, and he's going who knows where, and then in the middle of that, he's stopped in his tracks by a dream when he least expects it. You know, there's a lot here to be mined. That's always the case when there's four readings, and they're rich like this. And so we just have to kind of come at it from a particular way. And what I'd like to do today is to look at this through a particular lens. Understand there are many more lenses, but this is the one I'm going to pick up today. And that is to look at what I think lies close to the core of this story, and that's Jacob's restless heart and God's call for him to come home. Jacob's restless heart and God's call to come home. From the outset, Jacob wasn't happy with his life. He didn't like it. He didn't like the situation that he'd been given. He didn't like being second. And he set out to change that, whatever it would take. His restlessness was internal, and it was something that would be lived out externally as well as he sets out on the road. When he's forced to go on the run, it's nothing new, actually. He'd been running his whole life. You know, I've always thought about Jacob as a young man, maybe in his 20s. Is that how you see him in your head when he heads out on this journey, when he's banished and runs away to save his life? Because in his 20s, you know, he's still working out issues, isn't he? You know that some things were stacked against him anyway, so you can cut him some slack. Go easy on him. He's working all that out. He's growing up. But if you look closely at the narrative, you go back a few chapters and come forward doing the math, you'll see that he's actually much older. Jacob's mature in years. He may be even as old as his grandfather was when he was called to follow God. In other words, in his 70s. To me, that puts a really different spin on this story. This is a man who has lived the restless life for decades. He's had many restless years ahead of him as well. Deception, cowardice, duplicity, these were long ingrained patterns. These are the kinds of things that are really hard to shift, especially after all these years. We know something about restlessness, don't we? We live in a restless age. We're desperate for peace and tranquility, and yet we're afraid that we'll miss something if we slow down long enough to find it. So we keep the engine running at full tilt, hoping we'll find what we're looking for if we just keep moving on. I knew a guy that had moved 30 times. I know others who have moved more. The restless call forward. Now, being restless is not always a bad thing. God can use it in our lives to open a new chapter, to point out things that we need to address and to change about our lives. It's more a question of where the restlessness is taking us. Where's the destination? Where is it leading us? So in a vulnerable time on the run, in the midst of sleep, that's a time he has no control over, in a place far from anywhere, Jacob has this dream. It's a stairway. That's a better rendering of the word rather than ladder. It's a stairway. Maybe you've even seen the drawings of the ziggurats in the ancient Near East. The steps that go up. The idea in that time was that, you know, that people could climb to God. The stairway that goes up to heaven. And he sees that it is a portal to heaven, and there are angelic messengers going out on assignment and returning home. It's not a parade. Sometimes it's depicted as a parade in art, but it's the work of the divine, going and returning. And in that dream, God speaks to Jacob. The phrase above it that we have in verse 13, where it says, "There above it stood the Lord," can also mean next to, beside. And most of the Hebrew scholars that I consulted said we should take it to mean that in this case, that God is not way up at the top of the ladder, but he's standing next to Jacob. He's right next to him, close to him, standing on the ground. And in that place, speaking to him, God repeats the promise. The promise he had given to Abraham and Isaac, he now gives to Jacob, the one who had taken the blessing. Let's look at it. Starting at verse 13, it's printed in the bulletin. "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring." We've heard that before, haven't we? We've seen that promise and heard it already in Genesis several times. But then God goes on to make a personal promise just to Jacob. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I've promised you. This part of the promise relates to Jacob's restlessness, to the journey that he's on. It interrupts him and says, I'm giving you what I promised to your family, but even more, I'm giving you even more because I'm going to bring you back. God says to him, you are mine. I'm giving you this land, but even better than that, I'm giving you myself. You can leave this land, Jacob, but you can't leave me. You can leave this land, but you can't leave me. You've got a lot of journeying yet to do, but I'm going along. I'll protect you, I will not leave you, and in the end, I will bring you home. See, God is binding himself to this wanderer. He's making commitments to someone who doesn't know how to keep a commitment. That's really risky. God does risky things in our lives. God makes himself vulnerable all the time to us. And he certainly does that here with Jacob. He's getting out in front of Jacob as Jacob's running. He gets in front of him, basically, and reminds him who he is, who he's called to be, and where he belongs. And God is changing Jacob's trajectory. This is real for us. It happens in the people of God. It's a promise to Jacob and those who would come after. I really believe that. I think it's also a pretty good picture of baptism, especially when we baptize small ones. It's a picture of God getting in front of them, saying, you're mine. I'm going with you. You may wander, but you cannot shake me. So what does Jacob do? He wakes up, doesn't he? And he knows this was no dream. God has spoken to him directly, and in response to that, he worships. He sets up a stone as a sacred marker, and he calls it Bethel, the house of God. And if we read to verse 22, which I'd like us to do, and I can read it, it's actually to the end of the chapter. It adds a little bit more of Jacob's response. This is right after the last verse that you have printed. It says this, then Jacob made a vow. Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I'm taking and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God, and this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and all that you give me, I will give you a tenth. God's promise to Jacob, his commitment was unconditional. Jacob's response is pretty conditional. He says, if. Jacob's still being Jacob. We don't know where he was before this point in terms of his faith. He probably heard the stories. Maybe he even sat with his grandfather Abraham. But this divine encounter is the beginning of his journey home. God had been with him, but he did not know it. He has much more wandering to go, doesn't he? He has more restlessness to experience. But God has now bound himself to Jacob. I mean, what does Jacob do? I mean, coming on in the weeks ahead, we'll see some of this. He gets married twice. He's tricked by his uncle. Then he tricks his uncle. There's a lot more tricky things going on there. He wrestles with the angel, and he reconciles with his brother. And all of that is in the years ahead, many years. Even though Jacob still is the person he is, God is bringing him home. And Jacob does come back. He returns to this place of dreaming, to the land that was promised, and when he finally makes it back, he worships again at Bethel. And it's at that place that God changes his name to Israel, when he comes home. See, Jacob heads out today a fugitive, but he will return a pilgrim. Genesis 37 tells us that at the end of all his travels, Jacob settled in the land where his father had only been an alien. He settles in a land where those who came before him had not yet settled. He comes home. And the dream of the stairway and the words of promise interrupt his life with grace, and they forever shift his path to move him from restlessness to homewardness. I think this raises some questions for us. It does for me. And I wonder where we find restlessness in our own hearts. What is going on? Are we running? Are we running away from something? Are we running away from ourselves or from decisions we've made or that others have made? Are we open to a divine encounter that might change our direction? Do we seek that? And that's what happens in worship. That's part of gathering together. So there's always that potential for that when we gather. But there are other ways, too, to calm ourselves, to still our hearts, to listen to what God might say to us, to shift our direction, to bring us home. Jacob has the encounter while he's sleeping. I mean, you got to stop sometime, don't you? Can we stop long enough to hear God speak, to know him right next to us? The psalmist says, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" And the idea is, there's nowhere. Jacob woke up and he said, "God was here and I didn't know it." Where are the places where God is dwelling in our lives and we don't know it? For Jacob, it was a stone pillow in the middle of nowhere. When he became aware of God's presence, then it changed everything. It looked totally different. It was all of a sudden somewhere. It wasn't just a place, it became the place. It became home for him. It was the place he actually belonged, but he had no idea of it. Now, Jacob didn't have a remarkable and sudden change of personality. I'd like to report that he did. I went forward in a prayer line. I knelt at the altar. I stood up. I was totally new. I was totally different. Have you had that experience? I came to communion. I received the bread and the cup, and I was a new person. Well, that's true. That's true in so many ways, but we go out the door with ourselves again. And Jacob was still Jacob. He goes on pretty much as he had, but his awareness had changed. And he couldn't shake the knowledge that God was with him, and ultimately it brought him to a very different place than where he was headed. See, our journey can remain difficult, even after God steps into it for us, and sometimes it feels more difficult at those places. But God is with us. He's promised to be with us. God had in mind Jacob's end. A good, hopeful, and purposeful end to his journey, and that's God's heart for us as well. A heart that is patient with us. So patient, he leaves the weeds to grow among the good plants until the very last moment so that nothing he seeks to do will be lost. God promises Jacob the land and his own presence. He promises us the same, his life within and a true home. You may know Augustine's quote, our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Many of you know the work and the ministry of Henri Nouwen. In fact, I go to Nouwen to read him when I desire to catch a glimpse of peace and contemplation, when I want to hear a centered voice, when I want to bathe in wisdom that calls me to a still place. But I don't know if you know that Henri Nouwen was a tortured soul much of the time. His journey to God was driven by internal restlessness. He was always on the move in his life, always searching, always on to the next place, desperate for home. He was always reaching for love and for belonging. In fact, a number of his friends thought that his death of heart disease in his 60s, he was relatively young, was actually because of the pattern of his life and his travels and the way that he often spent himself without proper rest and without care. As we sort of close down this chapter of our conversation today in this, I would like to read something that Henri wrote about his own restlessness. "Dear Lord, I will remain restless, tense, and dissatisfied until I can be totally at peace in your house. But I'm still on the road, still journeying, still tired and weary, and still wondering if I will ever make it to that city on the hill. With Vincent van Gogh, I keep asking your angel, whom I meet on the road, does the road go uphill then all the way? And the answer is yes, to the very end. And I ask again, will the journey take all day long? And the answer is from morning till night, my friend. So I go on, Lord, tired, often frustrated, irritated, but always hopeful to reach one day the eternal city far away, resplendent in the evening sun. There's no certainty that my life will be any easier in the years ahead or that my heart will be any calmer. But there is the certainty that you are waiting for me and will welcome me home when I have persevered in my long journey to your house. O Lord, give me courage, hope, and confidence. Amen." Some of us are restless, folks. Some of us are walking in exiles of our own making. But God is wanting to get in front of us and say, "You're mine. You're mine. I have a home for you, and my intention and my desire is to bring you there, to bring you to that place." There's a phrase that Nouwen used that I want us to conclude with today, and it's this phrase: "I am a traveler on the way to a sacred place where God holds me in the palm of his hand." It's a confident statement. It's a hopeful statement. It's a loving statement. I'd like you to actually repeat it after me by phrase, because just put it in your mind and hold on to it. I am a traveler on the way to a sacred place where God holds me in the palm of his hand. Amen.